Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by David Robertson and myself, Christopher Cotter. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com.
Today, we are speaking with Professor Naomi Goldenberg from the University of Ottawa. Professor Goldenberg specialises in religion and gender, psychoanalysis and religion, and more recently, politics and religion. And today she will be talking about religions as vestigial states. So, Professor Goldenberg, welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you very much.
Welcome. So I guess the first question would be is, before we even speak about religion, what is a vestigial state?
I see this as a temporary concept until something better comes along. By vestigial state, I'm using the word vestige. And I was actually thinking of the word in terms of a whale skeleton the way they think about whales. No, actually, it would be a whale skeleton, that if you look at a whale skeleton, you see that there were the remnants of feet, perhaps, that were there. So there's a vestige of something that's left. So I was thinking in terms of how to contribute to the very exciting work that's being done here at Stirling on the deconstruction of religion, and in a way how to clarify some of, see through some of the mist and fog around the term. And I thought that it seemed clear to me as I studied what Tim Fitzgerald and others are saying, that there was a great deal of similarity between what we call states now and what we call religions, except that religions were about former states.
Right. Just to interrupt.
Sure. Oh, yeah. No, do, please. Yeah, right.
When you're talking about this, the analogy of the whale here, we're not talking in the more traditional sense of, we're getting down to the bare bones of religion. We're not looking for the essence of religion. We're looking for something
different. No, we're not. I don't think we have, there is an essence. Because the category is, attracts anything. In fact, I've been talking to Tim and some others. I don't think there's ever been anything that has ever been excluded from that category. There's not a single thing I can think of that has not, at one time or another, in one place or another, been categorized as religious. It's a challenge. If you think of something.
My own dissertation work was on whether Taekwondo was a religion or not.
I'm sure you can make it into.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. I mean, anything from dirt to air to numbers to absolutely anything can be in that category. So already, just on that alone, you know that there's a problem if nothing can ever be excluded from that kind of a category. Okay, but so I'm not saying there is an essence here. I'm talking about the way that category gets used in what I also think of as contemporary statecraft. Not just contemporary statecraft, perhaps statecraft if we think of contemporary going back a long time, because I see the process as happening.
Could you give a date to the long time?
A date for a long time. We could start maybe in one of the, I talk about the evolution of Jewishness. We could perhaps start with the destruction of the first temple in maybe 586 BC by the Babylonians. Maybe this is a good way to get into what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Because what begins to happen there is that you get a displaced, you get a government, more or less a fully functioning government, which had certain things going on around what's being called the temple. But from what we can tell, we know very little that actually happened there. Whatever rituals or meetings were going on had a lot to do with government. So you had a fully functioning, in a sense, government. Then you get an invasion, Babylonians. Yeah. You get a displacement. You get a physical displacement.
Right, yeah.
But you still have some of those people who are adherents to that within the new state. What does the state do with them? Well, the state gradually, and I'm not saying that religion is a category at that time, but gradually it evolves that unless those people are completely eliminated, which sometimes in some places they are, they're given a place and they're given limited powers. And the limited powers are what I think evolves into present day what we're calling a religion. So it's a way for a contemporary state to grant some sort of status to a former state that's been displaced. It's an advantage to the state, and it can be an advantage to the displaced state or the vestigial state, I'm saying.
Would this then make it superfluous to politics? I mean,
oh, absolutely not. It's absolutely central to politics. Now, what's wrong with... There's a lot wrong with the analogy of vestige, because the bone that's in the whale skeleton isn't going to grow into another foot, and whales, I don't think, aren't going to start walking around. Well, we're killing them off anyway, but whatever. They're not going to start walking around again. So what the word vestige does not convey is the idea that, in a sense, it's a radioactive vestige. Mm. It's always on the verge of becoming another state, a fully functioning state. So a good way, probably the best way, instead of vestigial state, is to call it a once and future state. But to me, that conjures more of a comic book, so I don't want to use the word once and future. Once and future prince, once and future king. But it's so you've got to understand that the word vestige isn't quite right.
So it's very much so not a static term. You're
absolutely
talking very
much
not about a transitory state.
It's dynamic.
Right.
So I think vestigial states are always, always trying to make the most of what the fully functioning state gives them and to increase that. Go ahead. Do you want to ask another question?
Well, no, I was just going to get you to elucidate on that further. So what you're saying is that the vestigial state is kind of the weak spot.
Circumscribed.
Of
it's circumscribed.
A community, and eventually it will presumably gain some sort of influence. And
well, I think it can be the strong part of the community. The community, it allows a community to exist. The one thing that fully functioning states deny, almost absolutely, is the right to legitimate violence. And that isn't me, that's Max Weber, that the state is the place or is the jurisdiction and authority that controls legitimate violence. So when we have a religion, a.k.a. a vestigial state, claiming to the ability or the right to commit violence, we start to hear that's not a real religion. That's not what religion does. So it's an interesting way, I think, of thinking of several things going on in the world now, such as Islam. In many states, Islam is, in a sense, the software of the state. It's not vestigial in any way. However, in certain Western democracies, Islam needs to be disciplined the way the Catholic Church has been, in a sense, disciplined to a degree, to give up certain things to become a religion. Sometimes I've talked about it, the castration of Islam into a religion. But one of the things that needs to be taken away is the right to violence.
Right.
And whereas in many states, that would be, you'd have Islamic control of the army, you'd have Islamic police, why not?
So it's very much so a question of mechanisms of power.
Yes, mechanism of powers and who has it and what gets denied. Mm. So the vestigial state or religion as a vestigial state allows for a lot of things to happen. One of the, I think, a contemporary example of this, which I think is a very, very interesting and strategic use of it, is what the Dalai Lama, the 14th Dalai Lama, has just done in the last several months. He has made various announcements saying that he thinks that he should divest himself of what he's calling political power and give this to an elected leader. So, in fact, the Tibetan people, who could be considered a state in exile according to various theories of international law, now have an elected leader who is supposedly the political head of state, whereas he, the Dalai Lama, is now head of what is the religion of Tibetan Buddhism. What he's doing with that is short-circuiting the Chinese claim to identify the next Dalai Lama, who then would have been somebody who had both what is called, and I think wrongly, political and religious power. So he's using the category of religion to create a vestigial state known as Tibetan Buddhism, all for the good of the Tibetan people. So I think it can be a very powerful strategic tool in contemporary statecraft, and that's a good example.
Okay, so there's a couple of things in there. Okay. Like, you're very much so, the political religious divide seems very much so an arbitrary thing.
It's an arbitrary thing.
Whoever has power is political, and whoever doesn't have
power. I'm not saying that. No, because it's the fully functioning state that determines what is a religion and what isn't.
Right.
And to a degree, I mean, sometimes the group that's called religion gains more and more traction and can get more and more powers. Your question is that who has the political power? No, I'm saying that I would say that it's all politics.
Right.
And I use the word politics in, I think, a very good sense, and I think a demystified sense. Politics comes from the Greek word for city. It also comes from a Greek word for head. So it's about people. Politics is about relationships between people. Polis itself, an urban center where presumably we all bump into each other a lot more often and we have a lot more things to organize. And I think that we need to think of religion that way. A criticism could be you're reducing religion to secular ideas. I'm not so sure. I think that, in fact, I don't think secular is a very unproblematic term as well. Mm. It sometimes, through history, has designated people who are not in the monastery, but everyone is Christian in accordance to secular religious understanding in some places.
But picking up on your use of politics and the Greek root there, because I've questioned Dr. Fitzgerald about this, about the Latin root and the politicus and the religio root.
Well, but they're coming from the same Greek, politicus. Mm. Yeah.
Yes,
Fitzgerald and I are having a little bit of an argument about that as well.
I was just wondering, because back then there is the distinction between politico and religious. And I mean, going along Fitzgerald's lines of saying that the religious is a term that we really shouldn't be using anymore, with your argument about a vestigial state, are you going along the same lines and saying that religion is no longer a viable category for us to use?
I'm not sure if I try not to use it. I think the problem I'm trying to address is that it is used in constitutions and in law, and it becomes, legal scholars are noticing this as more and more of a problem because they can't decide what is religious and what isn't, and they really need the kind of work you're doing here at Sterling to explain that there isn't an essentialized thing called religion that if they only understood it better they could make sense of, is that the category itself is very confused, unstable, incoherent, basically. So where were we with what you were?
We were talking about power mechanisms.
Power mechanisms.
You mentioned the Dalai Lama's move. Now, do you see that as him very much so creating a vestigial state and as preserving Buddhism?
He did it. He did it in a way. He did it for the good of the Tibetan people. He did it to make sure that the Chinese would have a problem in declaring the head of the Tibetan people. Mm. So now he split things up, and he said that the Dalai Lama is only going to have what we're calling religious powers, which is a circumscribed kind of power. And I think he's done a very interesting thing. Now, I think what he's done is a move of statecraft. It's a political move, and he's making use of categories that are available to him. As for the word religio, I remember something I wanted to pick up.
Sure.
In Roman times, what I see that word referring to are ritual practices that are aligned with the state. There isn't a great deal of a division here. Where you do have perhaps some of what I'm talking about, vestigial state, is a reference to former deities who are thought of as cults, or they'll be shrines to something else. And I think that underneath that is always a vestige of former government.
Right.
So that those cults are also representatives of former government. And I think what my concept might help to do is to make it clearer what's going on when we compare so-called religious law and secular law, that we're not talking about two different essences. We're talking about rules and regulations formed within one state and rules and regulations formed within another.
Because it's actually interesting that you went back to religio there just after mentioning the Dalai Lama and mentioning how that in ancient Roman times perhaps there wasn't this distinction between political and religious.
No.
Now you've got the Dalai Lama playing into that distinction, and to a certain extent, is that not playing into Western conceptions
of the world? Of course it is. Of course it is. But Western conceptions of the world are what have been creating these two categories, and they're useful. They're tools. So I don't want to say don't use it anymore. On the other hand, I might want to say don't write it into constitutions anymore, or don't treat laws as if they're very different from laws created by so-called secular governments. They're both created by governments. They're created by governments at different points in time. And I think related to an interest that I have in gender, of course, I think that that is why laws that are made in the vestigial states of religion tend to be much more sexist, much more patriarchal, because it's only very recently that women have gained some kind of traction for in legal rights and perhaps dignity in various forms of contemporary statecraft. And I don't like to see that being eroded by former kinds of statecraft.
Well, that brings us on to the next question. Yeah. I mean, what role does your vestigial state have in terms of gender and religion? I mean, what is the vestigial state theory telling us about difficult issues like gender and religion?
I think that this is just what I started to talk about, is it explains why the religious laws, so to speak, and I'm always putting it in quotes, and always, do tend to be very patriarchal, because states in the past, I know there are theories about matriarchies, but they haven't been, there's no proof for any of this at all. It was might makes right, and men have dominated states and governments throughout any kind of recorded human history. So that those laws, which I don't think we should see as some sort of mystical essence or something that needs to be continued and repeated, are the products of former male-dominated governments. In some laws today, we're getting a little bit less male-dominated in some governments, and it's very fragile. So I think hearkening back to those laws is something that we should be very, very careful about. That's what I think may be helpful in thinking about religions as vestigial states, at least in regard to law.
Now, I'm wondering, because the way you're talking about it, are you pro taking a very active role in politics through religious studies?
Religious studies already has a very active role. To think that it doesn't is a mystification of politics. To say that religion is outside of politics is a game that can be played strategically to very great advantage, but it doesn't work. And of course, religious people should have their role in, should be able to speak in political settings, and they should be able to bring forth their whatever arguments, theistic arguments or whatever, to be argued about in the same ways that other arguments are put forward. I'm not sure whether this idea of vestigial state eliminates an idea of God at all, because in a sense, we're all, in any kind of a state, we're setting up some kind of an abstraction that we're supporting, even perhaps justice or equality or a homeland or an idealized people. So I think that the God concepts still exist, whether in perhaps more recent state or past states, the way I'm formulating this now. I think that it could perhaps be maintained.
So is religious studies itself a kind of vestigial state that allows this discourse to take place?
I don't think religious studies is a state. It's a field in which this kind of inquiry into categories, very basic categories of, I hate to use the word, but I'm using it, modernity, have been formed, and it's an opportunity for a demystification of power, which is a great goal, demystification of the kinds of institutions that form our world, and an opportunity to see more of our human construction and the history of our human construction and encounters with one another in these categories.
Now, you just mentioned the demystification of power, and
yeah.
I just wanted to question that, because, yes, you can demystify the current power, but in so doing, are you not then opening the way to let another mystified power take its place?
Oh, that's always true, but otherwise you're not going to do anything. Because, of course, we're always, I'm not pretending that we're making a construction that isn't itself a construction. Mm. But we can be aware of the constructed nature of the constructions that we're making and perhaps continue to talk about it, much better than forming a construction that can't be questioned or a construction that's essentialized and reified and can't be approached or taken apart.
Mm. So does there need to be a level of care in what we're talking about?
Always, because... always. Compassion, awareness, and wisdom should be motivating the whole enterprise. And I hope it is. Mm. Because I certainly think that that's what's motivating the inquiry. I see so many things done in the name of religious law, which particularly in relation to women are abhorrent.
Mm.
And I'd like to see that more approachable. Made more approachable.
But in the question of demystification of power and the fact that we, from our particular position, see the treatment of women in certain cultures as abhorrent, is that not a relativistic position in the sense that...
Relativistic in regard to whom? Because in all of these cultures, there are women who are opposing those practices. Mm. And by only supporting the ones who are supporting tradition, what you're doing is siding with the patriarchs.
Yeah.
You're not siding with the oppositions in those particular cultures who are opposing those things. Because women in whatever cultures that we're naming, where we're saying abhorrent things are going on, are opposing these things. And if we cast our lot with the traditional patriarchs, we're doing violence, in a sense, to those women. So I think you need to look at what's going on in the culture. You're always right. going to find a group who is opposed to what the tradition is supporting. But if, as Western countries, we're always siding with what we're deciding is the authentic view, which is the patriarchal view, because there's a nostalgia involved in all this. The perhaps something we haven't gotten into yet, that the vestigial states support a masculine hegemony in the fully functioning states because they are the past.
Mm.
They are the authorizing, in a sense, tradition. So when we have constitutions which name a male god, for example, as someone who is an originary force behind a constitution, we're hearkening back to a nostalgia. So therefore, we have to be very careful in what traditions we're authenticating. We're tending to authenticate the patriarchal ones.
Right. What happens if we run the argument in reverse,
right,
to a certain extent, in the sense that we have a state,
yes,
which we agree with, we don't find their practices abhorrent, but within that state there is a group,
yes,
a minority group, who start practicing acts that we then view as abhorrent. What right do we then have to have an involvement within that discussion? Because I guess what I'm saying is that we like states because they happen to be the same as our kind of states at the moment. But if something were to change in that state, would we still have...
Well, I think there are values. I think there are values that you have to think of as establishing a certain level of care for human beings. And if there is a group within a state that is doing something that is harmful to human beings, I think that as other human beings, we have a right, even a duty, to speak up about that and do something about it. And the label of we're doing this because it's religious and therefore we can get away with it is something that we should be questioning. We meaning that I'm talking about the good guys, supposedly. And it's very interesting that what happens in cases of domestic violence, for example, is sometimes excused because it's done in a religious culture. It's allowed. And certain kinds of groups within Britain, I know, are being empowered. Men, community leaders, are empowered as spokespeople for these supposedly religious groups in which violence against women occurs, and the British state doesn't intervene as much as it should, perhaps, or perhaps lighter sentences are given because the violence is being seen as being done for religious reasons. This is something that I think needs to be on the table.
You've just been listening to Jonathan speaking with Professor Naomi Goldenberg. And now, next week, we've got something pretty special coming up for you, so David and I thought we would both talk to you for a bit longer than usual. Basically, you might remember about 10 weeks or so ago, probably a bit more, we had a compilation podcast on what is the future of religious studies, which featured a number of our interviewees from the previous interviews. So what we've got for you next week is scholars tackling the question of should scholars of religion be critics or caretakers? This features, amongst others, we've got Eileen Barker, Linda Woodhead, Stephen Sutcliffe, Timothy Fitzgerald, Grace Davey, and a whole host of other scholars involved talking about this issue. And the issue was sparked by Russell McCutcheon's book, which is called Critics, Not Caretakers. And we thought it would be great to also get Russell McCutcheon to offer a response to the compilation of other scholars. So that's what we've got coming up for you next week. In other news, David wants to tell you about our summer break.
Yeah, the week after the Critics and Caretakers episode goes out, we are going to be taking a short summer break. We think about 6 weeks. Not because we don't have the recordings. We have recordings up until about November at this point. But just to give everybody a chance to catch up. It's been a busy time of the year for listeners as well as ourselves. So give you a bit of a chance to catch up with the 27 podcasts we'll have up by that point. And also for us to make a few subtle changes behind the scenes. We've got some plans brewing about interviews coming from other continents, as Chris mentioned last week. But during that time, we're not going to be disappearing completely. We've all chosen our favourites from the this first semester, if you like, of the podcast. So we'll be putting those out with new introductions during the break. We've also got a few other special articles. We've got a roundtable or two to come. So we'll still be around. And then we'll be back with our regular scheduled programme some point in September. So watch out for that. But for now, I think we'd both like to say
thanks for listening.